Podcast of the cinema.
But what's your name? Is it Mike?
Stop.
Is your name Mike? Mike, what's your last name, Mike? Is it Mike Check? Is Mike Check your
Mike
last name?
Check,
Mike
certainly.
Check is your last name? Is
yes.
Check? It's Check, right?
Yes.
God, I swore it was something else.
My middle name is Sibilance.
I could have sworn your last name was something else.
Stop it. I'm Alonzo Duralde, film reviews editor for The Wrap, co-host of the Breakfast All Day and Who Shot You podcasts, and of course, co-host of this podcast with you, Dave White.
My name is Dave White. I too am a film critic for The Wrap. That was an accident. I mean, it kind of was. I quit my old job.
There are no accidents.
Remember when I used to work for movies.com?
Yes,
yes,
I do.
What a drag that was.
That was, you were gainfully employed by them for quite some time.
10 years.
Yeah.
And a good 8 of them were okay.
Yeah.
The last 2 were hell on earth.
Well.
Now it can be told. And then one day, I was like, you know what? Later, dudes.
You Done. Can't fire me. I quit.
You can't fire me. I quit. Then one day you said to me, hey, no one wants to review this movie. The Ethan Hawke movie. What was it called? The horror movie.
Not Insidious. The other one. The other one that's an adjective. Superfluous. I forget.
It was the one with the black metal.
The home movies.
Yeah, the whole movie's and the villain that looked like the black Bagul.
Mm.
What's that movie called? Anyway, Impertinence.
Yes. Flatulence.
I'm just completely blanking on the title. Anyway, you're like, nobody wants to review this. Or somebody dropped out. Something like that.
Something like that.
Last minute. Like, can you go? Please, 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 please. It's like, no. No, no. No, that's nepotism. Not doing that.
I'm painting my toenails.
That's that. Your spouse gets to do this? Okay, great. Here I am, trying to be a freelancer out here, and the editor's husband gets to review a movie. I said no.
You got bona fides. They got nothing to do with me.
I said no. I said you go talk to your boss. You make sure it's okay with your boss. Then I might consent. I don't review without consent.
Mm.
I might consent to be your minion. So I did. I reviewed that movie. You know what? I was so good at it that I just kept reviewing and reviewing and reviewing.
That's right. The Wrap is lucky to have you.
I like to think so.
Because
Sinister.
Sinister! I can never remember that one.
Sinister. It was very sinister.
Ethan Hawke is left-handed in Sinister.
It was not a bad movie. And then for like the next year, you were like, hey, my other person dropped out last like 20 minutes. The screening's in an hour. Can you go? Please, 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 please. I'd be like, I'll think about it.
Go see this movie about haunted houses in Italy.
I had to be... Oh, God. No, it was like in India, right?
I don't remember.
Wasn't it a haunted house... Like a haunted house movie that was taking place in India?
Maybe. You saw it, not me.
What was that one called?
I don't know.
That was terrible. Beyond the Door or something like that?
Something like that.
Yeah. For a while, it was all just a bunch of horror movies. I was like, I'm fed up. Put me on the art house beat.
You got, I sent you to a Captain America movie once.
You did. Never do that again. People following me on Twitter because of that?
Oh, how dare
Who
they?
Who needs that?
How dare they?
Oh, nobody wants that. Too many people following you on Twitter. They just start bothering you all the time. Telling you things. Asking you for your top five whatever movies. What's your favorite blah blah movie? I don't have one.
You Goodbye. Don't have to respond.
You're blocked. Ask me a question, I'll block you.
I don't know where Bibbs finds the energy and wherewithal to do it, but he's constantly like, ask me anything, and he will actually give these well-thought-out answers. I'm like, dude, you're giving it away. What's going on?
Bibbs is the ask me anything king.
Yeah.
And I'm like, ask me nothing. Ask me permission to ask me something. How about that?
Ask me for consent.
People... Listen, if you follow me on Twitter, I love you so much. You know why I love you so much? Because you don't bother me very much. You know what's nice? Actually, the people who follow me on Twitter, they just link things to me and tag me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nice. Like, because then I have information maybe that I did not have before.
Yes.
Things that are relevant to my interest. Mostly, like, cookie recipes, which is great.
Well, see, there you go. Who says the internet isn't good for things?
This week, I just got a link. Steven was telling, linked me to the Placido Domingo story. I already heard all about that.
Oh, yeah.
Ugh, that mess.
Because
you know I'm a big opera person. I'm a big opera person. Well, love that opera.
If you thought opera wasn't going to get me too'd, well.
Well, yes. Listen, it's all over the world.
Yes.
That's everywhere. Anyway, now I know about Placido Domingo again. And so, what was I talking about?
Twitter.
People bothering me on Twitter. Yes. I'll block you. just you wait. Maybe I'll soft block you.
Yeah, mute them.
I'll mute you.
Let them scream into the void and wonder why you're not responding.
No one actually, you know, it's so, I'm just talking a lot of nonsense because no one ever yells at me on Twitter.
Mm.
No one ever comes to me and talks, you know, ish to me. Nobody is, like, they are not nice to you. People come to you every week and they're like, meh, meh, meh.
Not so much on Twitter.
Where do they do it?
On YouTube.
Well,
breakfast all day stuff.
That's because you're reading their comments. Don't do that. Don't do that.
I generally don't, but
you say that all the time. You always go, I generally don't, but then like no. You either do or you do not.
Okay.
There is no try.
You're right, I know. Well, there's this thing when I'm logged into YouTube as Breakfast All Day, mm-hmm. it like tells me in the corner like how many new comments there are. It's just like, you know, it's hard not to comment. Okay.
No.
You're right. I should stop.
No. You think Twitter's a toxic cesspool?
Oh no, YouTube's the worst. YouTube is like heinous. Is like barely formed personalities lashing out in anger.
I only lash out in anger at our president, but he can't hear me because I don't do it on Twitter.
No,
if I did, I'd be every day. I'd be tweeting at him, "Go F yourself," and then I would get. Like, the FBI would come to my door.
Yeah, I bet he doesn't look at responses.
No, like, of course he doesn't.
He just bleats into the void and retweets despicable people.
Speaking of despicable, I do not like Trader Joe's.
It's not my favorite.
Perhaps this seems like a jump from one subject to another. It is. But we just came from Trader Joe's.
We were at the movie at 8000 Sunset, and then we went to Trader Joe's.
We had to see The Good Boys.
Yes.
And then...
You know there's no the.
We had to go... Whatever. And then we had to go to the Trader Joe's and get the spinach and the cheese.
Yes.
Because that's dinner. Spinach and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Just spinach topped with cheese. And... Boy, Sunday afternoon at Trader Joe's. What a...
Trader Joe's is one of those things where, like, mess. People that don't have them where they live get very excited when they're going to finally get
don't
one.
Get excited.
I don't know why. I've never seen the
Do
big...
Do not get excited.
I like the dark chocolate-covered almonds
crowded
a lot.
Places. Loud. There's, like, a bell always going up. Someone's always ringing a bell.
Yeah, their produce is not great.
I ran into a neighbor that I met at a pool party, and I saw him, and I was like, I know you somehow.
Well, that's not Trader Joe's fault. That's you having a...
I know you.
You having a faulty memory.
Beat, beat, beat. Ah, yes, now I know who you are. He was gone. So now I'm a jerk.
You're the one who has to remember people, because I never remember anyone.
I know. The one good thing about that experience was we got in and out fast, because I knew that we had 15 minutes left on the free parking.
Yes.
You get 3 hours of free parking if you go to a movie. And we got there early to eat lunch, not ate up time.
Yes.
And then the movie ate up time, and then all the trailers before the movie ate up time.
So many trailers.
By the time we got out, we had 15 minutes left on our free parking. And I thought, oh, Trader Joe's, you're not going to screw me out of free parking. I'm going to knock people over in that place to get what I need and get out. We made it with 5 minutes to spare.
It's true.
Felt pretty proud of myself.
I'm trying to remember what all the trailers were.
Well, when you do, don't talk about them until we talk about them on Linoleum Nights.
Right, no, I know that's where we talk about trailers now.
We talk about trailers now on our other show called Linoleum Nights.
How do you get Linoleum Nights,
Patreon, Dave? We'll tell you about it later.
We will.
We're talking about five movies this week. I did not catch up on the following films. I did not catch up on The Art of Racing in the Rain. I'm saving that. I'm saving that for when you go to Italy.
Fine.
Like, Fine. I'll be chilling in the theater alone. It'll still be in theaters there's nothing else coming
out. There is not enough grape soda in the world to get you through that movie.
It's going to be a big grape soda? It's going to be a big grape soda.
Okay.
I also did not catch up on Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. But I'm probably going to hit that one back-to-back with Racing in the Rain while you're in Italy. Because all I have to do while you're in Italy is fulfill Patreon t-shirts, mugs, and pins and magnets and stickers and...
Christmas ornaments.
Christmas ornaments, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of merch. It's all in the back office.
Yes.
But that's it. That's all I have to do. So I'll be hitting a nice chill double feature... Alone, no friends. Probably nobody else in the theater. That'll be nice. But you did see Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
I did see Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
And I need you to tell me, should I go see that one first or second? Like, on my day, on my afternoon that I go, which one... do I need to knock out of the way first?
Get Art of Racing in the Rain out of the way first. Because
is it longer?
It might be.
I
don't
know. Go with the longer movie first.
Okay, that I don't know. I did not
the
know
longer
there would be math.
And more boring.
You did not.
Which
ask
one is
me.
Longer and more boring?
Oh, more boring is Art of Racing in the Rain. Even if Art of Racing in the Rain is shorter, it's still more boring.
Okay.
That movie is just like hacky garbage.
All right, cool.
Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, I found quite entertaining. You will be less into it because you are more less scarable than I am.
I need to tell you something, by the way.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. We go on the radio. Our local national public radio station, KCRW, has us on once a month.
Yes.
On the Press Play Show, hosted by Miss Madeline Brand. She's a delight.
She is.
We love her. We love being on her show. This week, they had us in to talk about 47 Meters Down, Uncaged.
Yes, which we'll be getting to.
And you went off on me and my my non-behavior in horror movies.
You've talked about it on this show.
Hang on. You just hang on.
Jump scares. You I see this coming a mile away.
You just calm it down. I have discussed my semi-immunity to jump scares. Mm-hmm. Not because I'm so rough and tough, but because I have seen lots and lots of horror films, and horror films that are not well made make the jump scares easy to know when they're coming, because they just copy the way other movies do jump scares. Quiet, 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 quiet. Loud, 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 loud. Boom. Right. The cat jumps out of the closet. The shark jumps out of the dark part of the screen.
Wow.
You didn't see it before. Oh, boom. Shark in your face. Now, but that's not the point. The point is not that I can predict a jump scare and therefore they don't make me jump. The point is that what you said on the air, and here's the other thing. They pre-taped this show. Yes. We go in at 10 and they air it at 1 in the afternoon. We go in the morning, they air it at 1 in the afternoon. You said that I sit there with my buttocks clenched. And they left it in.
Well, you know what?
They let it go out over the air. And I just want you to know, and I want the world to know, my buttocks are relaxed and supple.
When I tried that line on you in the car, I said sphincter, but I decided not to go with that for NPR. I went with...
Because it's much classier.
I went with buttocks.
Well, I'll tell you, you know what?
I feel like we're on Match Game now.
I
went with buttocks.
My lack of response to a jump scare has absolutely nothing to do with my beautiful, beautiful, soft and shapely buttocks.
Your ample derriere.
They're never clenched. They're free and easy. So you learn that about me.
Uh-huh.
And know in the future, when you're on the radio with me, talking about me on the radio.
Should I issue a correction next
makes
time?
Makes you want to treat me with a little more respect, doesn't it?
Next time we go on, should I say, everybody.
Retraction.
Dave White's keister is loosey-goosey.
Retraction. I demand an NPR retraction.
Dave's badonkadonk is easy like Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah, it is.
Fair enough. But Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is not jump scare dependent. Okay. So you might actually dig it. I don't know. I had a good time. It is set in 1968. They very cleverly use the proximity of Halloween to Election Day.
Yes.
Because the story opens on Halloween, but takes us up through the election night of Richard Nixon.
Okay.
So there's a little bit of commentary on, you know, where we are now.
Right. In a kid's movie.
And also the specter of the Vietnam War is hanging over some of the older teen characters.
Okay.
But basically it is about this group of high school friends who befriend a stranger in town. They all go to the sort of like town creepy house, you know, where the rich family used to live, where there was the daughter that they kept hidden away, and she would tell terrifying stories that would, you know, then kill children, is the legend.
Okay.
And the girl finds the daughter's book of stories and takes it with her.
Yeah.
And of course havoc ensues and scary stories start writing themselves in the book, and it leads to terrible consequences for the characters. I have no familiarity with the source material.
All right.
You and I were both too old for Goosebumps and for
Correct.
Fear Street and for Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark and a lot of that stuff. We are elders.
Yeah.
So I'm not slagging on it. I'm not too cool for it. I just was too old. So I never read them. Don't know this at all. Coming in completely cold. Apparently, the creature design borrows very heavily from the legendary sort of original illustrations of these books that some parents deemed too scary, so the books were reprinted with less scary illustrations, but OG fans know the real deal illustrations, and apparently recent reprints have restored them.
Let your kids see a scary drawing.
Yes. So Guillermo del Toro, you know, executive produced it, and he, you know, knows his way around a creature. It's directed by this guy who did the Troll Hunter, I think both the film and the Netflix series.
Yes.
And it's well done. It's well put together. I liked the performances. You know, the cast includes, I'm pulling it up. I know the town bully is played by the guy who is the son in Brad Status, who's also the nice guy on Euphoria, who is in love with the girl who's secretly a cam girl.
Yes.
But Zoe Margaret Coletti plays the lead. You know, Michael Garza, Gabriel Rush.
My Sig bottle just fell out of the dish rack and back into the sink.
Scary stories to tell in the sink.
Scary bottles to fall in the podcast.
There is one thing that, Andre Overdahl, by the way, is the director's name. Mm-hmm. There is one thing that I have seen some people complaining about, and they're not wrong, which is this is one of those movies about, like, weird occulty stuff.
Yes.
Where the person with the answers is, for lack of a better way of putting it, because that's basically what she is in the movie, the old voodoo lady. Lorraine Toussaint plays this, like, you know, octogenarian, you know, with secrets. And that's a trope that we could sort of live without,
yes,
maybe.
I'd say so.
But generally speaking, I think I'm a fan of, because I'm such a wimp when it comes to horror, I'm a big supporter of the slumber party horror movie. The, like, the good PG-13 horror movie, and there are some,
mm-hmm.
you know, like Drag Me to Hell or the second Ouija movie, you know, that's not, like, super gory, super scary, but, you know, scary enough, and, mm-hmm. and we'll keep, you know, like, young teens entertained.
You're 10. It's a slumber party.
Yeah.
You watch this movie.
You know, like, you know, Paranorman and Coraline and...
Those aren't horror films, though.
Coraline's pretty creepy.
But it's not a horror film.
A case could be made.
Man, you are soft.
Well, it also depends on your definition of horror, you know.
Is it frightening?
Yeah.
Coraline is not a frightening film.
The Other Mother?
Are you 5 years old? Then Coraline is a frightening film.
Whatever, buttocks.
Unclenched.
Free and easy.
Free and easy.
Anyway, go see it after you've endured Art of Racing in the Rain. I'll be curious to hear what you think about it.
Let's talk about Good Boys.
Sure.
We just saw it.
We did. It's kind of like Superbad Junior.
Yeah. Yeah.
Three sixth graders who are best friends, who have been best friends since kindergarten. It's the beginning of the school year, and we're starting to get the hints of that tipping point between childhood and adolescence, and that moment where, like, the kids who've been your friends all along, you maybe start having separate interests and separate, you know, ways of doing things.
Right.
But at the moment, they are still, you know, one for all and all for one.
Jacob Tremblay. A kid named Keith Williams.
Keith L. Williams.
He's on Last Man on Earth.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if that show's still on.
I don't know.
Anymore. And then another kid named Brady Noon.
Yes.
Who I've never seen before. Oh, he was on Boardwalk Empire.
Okay.
But he was, like, little.
Yeah, if that's Boardwalk 9 years ago. Like, yeah. He was a zygote. So,
and that was it until now.
So Jacob Tremblay's character has a crush on a girl, gets invited, the cool kid in class, who's like the weeest boy in the class.
He's tiny. He's and, littler than everybody else.
And yet somehow
he's the boss of the school.
Totally. Yeah. Is having a kissing party. And so Tremblay gets invited, but he wants to bring his two friends with him, even though they are less cool than he is. And complications emerge when they try to figure out how kissing works, which involves spying on their neighbors with a drone, which he's not supposed to be using. And it sets off a chaotic adventure in which they have to replace the drone, and there's drugs involved and sex toys that they don't know what they are. And
well, it's an R-rated comedy.
Yes, it is very much an R-rated comedy.
Children who are not, who have just enough information about the adult world.
Yes.
To know that, well, they don't know. They have just enough information about the adult world to be completely wrong about everything they encounter.
Mm-hmm.
What body parts are supposed to do.
Yes.
What adult items are for. What adult activities are, what drugs do. You know, you grow up knowing that drugs are bad. Drugs are bad. They destroy this, yeah, and this.
They destroy bodies and communities.
Yeah, yeah. So you, and these are the things you repeat. You repeat everything you have been told. It's like, I had a young family member once in the year 2008 say to me that she hoped Obama would not get elected president because he was a socialist. And I thought to myself, my sweet, darling little child, you don't know what that word means. Your father said it to you. And I looked at her and I said, ha ha, I wish he was a socialist because that's what I am, and I'm voting for him in spite of that. I'm sure she had to go figure out what in spite of meant, but that's just an example of really what this film is. It's about not knowing, and it's... I'll tell you something else. The kids in this movie, the child characters in this film, are way more sophisticated in terms of being connected to the world than you and I were at that
age. We did not have iPads.
Did you have that kind of profane vocabulary when you were that age? Were you swearing with your friends?
Yes, but probably badly. Like, you know, incorrectly, I should say.
Oh, I was not. I was literally a good boy. Like, you wouldn't hear a swear out of my mouth ever. It was not in private, not among my friends, anywhere. It was bad.
No, I swore because I had older siblings, and they all did. So,
right. You know. But did they do it in the home?
Not like not in front of my parents, but you know, elsewhere. Yes,
these kids use the R-rated language, and even then, sometimes they aren't using it
quite right.
Quite right. Yeah.
And other words in general, like, you know, when the kid says he's a social piranha.
Right. Yes. Yes. So the bulk of the joke in this film is about innocence.
Yes.
And it's about how, in spite of the fact that you think that you are a big kid now.
Yes.
There's one, at one point, Jacob Tremblay says, look, are we fifth graders or are we sixth graders? And of course, the answer is you're five.
It doesn't, you're either way, it's the same
thing. It doesn't really matter. I mean, it matters to you. But the idea that each stage of childhood and into adolescence, everything feels monumental, everything feels important, everything feels permanent. You live with a sense of permanence, and the reality of impermanence becomes, if all other things are equal, that becomes your first trauma.
Right.
And one of the kids in the movie, his parents are getting divorced, and he learns this in the early part of the film, in the first, like, 15 minutes. And that actually sets the tone for whatever everything else that's happening with these three boys, because impermanence is now grabbing them.
Right. Part of what's driving the plot is the idea that they have to do everything together and that they have to, like...
And nothing can change.
And nothing can change. They have to stay together, yeah.
Yeah.
This also might be one of the first movies since Stand By Me that lets pre-adolescent kids boys specifically cry? We don't see that a lot, and that's kind of a taboo thing. You don't see men cry in movies a lot, and you definitely don't see boys crying over emotion.
Right, right.
And they do in this film, and I was like, oh, that to me felt like it felt something like something bold that I wasn't expecting in what is clearly meant to be sort of a kind of sweet and raunchy R-rated comedy.
My head is telling me the film adaptation of Bridge to Terabithia has a boy crying.
That might. I'm not saying never, but
it can't be sure.
But it's rare. Yeah. It is pretty rare.
That film in particular, anyway, is very much
an outlier.
It's an outlier. It's a dark
children's
film. The Secret Garden. Agnieszka Holland's The Secret Garden has a boy crying.
True.
In it. Yeah, but here I'm scraping for titles. So yeah, you're probably right. I hadn't considered that actually.
I just like that because I think that, you know, you read so much about. We just talked about this in some context or other about how boys are conditioned to like not touch each other, to not, you know, express their feelings,
to not cry.
But basically, anything that can be put under the umbrella of that's gay.
Or that's for girls.
Yeah.
One or the other or both.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I mean, I just saw that study where, like, straight guys who don't recycle because they think it's gay. Like, come on.
How?
That's a thing. Google it.
What is that?
Apparently, there was some study of, like, they found a lot of straight guys who did not, like, recycle or do sort of, you know,
because
they thought it was gay.
Explain what gay and like homosexual or just not masculine enough.
I imagine the latter, but I didn't read deeply into the whole thing.
Because that's when straight guys call something gay, what they're really saying is that they're
threatened by
their
it.
Their masculinity is feeling threatened.
Right.
Yeah.
So like it's
they know it's not going to turn them into, you know, smoochers of men.
Well, like in this movie, it's interesting because you have on the one hand these kids who are obviously being taught very early about the idea of consent, you know, which comes up a lot of times in the film, even though at the same time they're still completely baffled about actual sex.
Yeah, they have no idea.
Yeah.
They have no idea what it is, what it's about. They accidentally go on to a Pornhub type site because they're looking for video instruction on how to kiss.
Yes.
And instead they find something else that they describe later.
Right.
And they don't understand what it is they have seen.
Right.
Yeah. So I think this is a very sweet natured film.
Yes.
It's not.
They are marketing it as the sort of raunchy, you know, children's swear movie, but it is very sweet.
It's emotionally present. It's very sweet, and it's about how, in spite of all the, you know, adult situations and profanity, it's about how the culture can, if the culture will all join together in this project, allow boys to be human beings.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, macho beasts. And what you see through the course of this film is the possibility of three, you know, 11-year-olds growing up to be good men.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, who grow up to be different people, but who still figure out how to be friends.
And yeah, and their emotions get to remain intact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was very pleasantly surprised by this, and I laughed very consistently.
Yeah, me too.
So, yeah, check this one out.
I agree. It's not an urgent film. You don't need to rush out to see it.
It won't lose anything on the small screen,
correct,
necessarily.
Yeah, not at all.
But, yeah. Well, I was going to say, you know, but support the R-rated comedy. It's the number one movie this weekend. It's fine. But three of my favorite films this year have been R-rated comedies. This, Booksmart, and Longshot.
I would like to say that I need two Booksmarts for every film like this.
Fair enough. No question.
Because of cinema history.
Well, yes.
The end.
That's a long and winding road.
Yes.
Speaking of cinema history, we are so excited to introduce Ovid.tv, the new streaming service for art house films, international cinema, and documentaries.
This is the advertisement.
It is. Described by the New York Times as a haven for indie gems, Ovid.tv features films such as Claire Denis' Trouble Every Day, Deborah Granik's Stray Dog, Raul Ruiz's Time Regained, and some new additions to the service.
Here's what I like. The new thing I like on Ovid.
Uh-huh.
It's a documentary.
Yeah.
You know I love them documentaries.
I know you do.
And Ovid's got a lot of documentaries.
Tons.
More than I can watch. Like, I'll never watch all of them. Like, but I'm happy they're there.
Yes.
You know what else? You know what other kind of documentary I like?
What's that?
Short. there's one called Dear Dr. Spencer that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's from 1998. It's 30 minutes long. It's about a guy named Robert Douglas Spencer, and he was a doctor in a small town in a coal portion of Pennsylvania. And he pretty much took care of the town, but he also performed safe and illegal abortions from the 1920s. Until his death in the late 1960s.
Wow. So pre-Roe v. Wade.
His first one was in 1923. And word spreads when you do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And women started coming to him. Because they knew that it would be, you know, physically safe for them to go to him.
Right.
The community all kept his privacy.
Wow.
They sort of knew what was going on. You know, it was one of those, they talk about it, but no one says anything.
Hmm.
And they even protected him every time the state police tried to shut him down.
Hmm.
So the town kind of gathered around this guy and let him do what he needed to do. For these women, he is estimated to have done more than 40,000 of them.
Wow.
From the 20s to the 60s.
Hmm.
If you've ever seen Claude Chabrol's story of women with Isabelle Huppert,
yeah,
late 80s, early 90s film, that's about a woman who performs abortions in France during wartime.
Or Mike Leigh's Vera Drake.
Or Mike Leigh's Vera Drake, yeah. This is a real life, you know, companion story.
Wow. They've also got a brand new, I don't know if it's a brand new, but they have, new to Ovid, they have a documentary called Trespassing Bergman about the life and work of Ingmar Bergman, where they interview the likes of Lars von Trier and Martin Scorsese. So lots of very cool stuff happening.
I said this is our last spot.
Yeah,
we're doing four of them for them. Yeah, this is our last Ovid spot.
Yes,
I'll listen. I mean, I love getting paid for that,
mm-hmm.
but I would just talk about them anyway.
Don't tell them that.
Well, they're hearing it probably, so I guess the joke's on me.
Baja. As a special introductory offer for Linoleum Knife listeners, save 50% off the first 3 months of your subscription. Head over to ovid.tv. That's www.ov, as in Victor, ID as in David, .tv. Sign up with coupon code podcast. You'll get ovid.tv for just $3.50 a month for the first three months.
$3.50.
Yes.
That's insane.
Yes.
I mean.
And the offer expires August 31st, so get on it.
What is it after the 3 months?
I guess $7, because you're saving 50%. Oh, that's still
is that the discount 50%?
Yeah,
we've been saying that every week, and I just wasn't adding things
you
right.
You and numbers, I know.
I wasn't doing numbers.
You'll have access to hundreds of films not available on any other platform, and you can start streaming them on all your favorite devices, including Apple TV and Roku.
What am arithmetic, Alonzo?
Is our children learning?
No, me isn't. Ever. Really, ever.
Clearly.
Why don't you... I'm going to do this. 47, okay. 47 meters down.
Okay.
Uncaged. Is like that box of Cap'n Crunch that's called Oops All Berries.
Go on.
Well, you know, you open it up and maybe you didn't notice that it said Oops All Berries. You open it up and it's all berries and you're like, eh. Is it all we have to eat for breakfast? I suppose I will eat it. You know I love a shark movie.
You love a shark movie called 47 Meters Down.
I loved a shark movie called 47 Meters Down. Starring Mandy Moore.
Mm-hmm.
Should have known.
She kills a shark with a crock pot.
Should have known when she wasn't back for this one that I shouldn't come back for this one either. Where Mandy Moore leads, I follow.
You think Mandy Moore's character in that movie is going to go 47 meters down again?
No, she learned her lesson. About.
So they got to find somebody else to go 47 meters down.
Four teens, all in bikinis.
Yes.
Oh, and the camera loves that. Camera sure does love them in bikinis. It's a bikini world.
They stuff a wild bikini.
Yeah. Then they all jump in the water and they go scuba diving in an underwater cave. They're not supposed to be doing this. They're breaking all the rules. Underwater cave has an old temple. It's like ancient ruins.
Yeah.
It's real creepy and spooky down there. Also, oops, all sharks. blind sharks.
Yes.
That can still find you somehow and eat you efficiently
anyway.
Well,
they've been... It's like other fish that live, you know, where there's no light at the bottom of the sea. They have other... They have...
Sure.
Senses.
This is a stupid, boring movie about stupid people behaving badly. Teens, when someone tells you don't do something for your own safety, don't do it. It's unsafe. This is about teens being bad and unimaginable consequences, right?
Mm.
That when the film ends, those consequences are not explored at all. The film simply
What did you
ends.
Want? Grieving parents at the end?
The film simply ends. Can I just spoil it? I shouldn't, should I?
Maybe don't.
Okay. Well, obviously there's death. People do get eaten in the movie. But a person in this film gets eaten who would not have been eaten had these people, these
behaved.
Had these teens behaved.
Yes.
So a person who didn't do anything wrong gets eaten. And when the film ends, we never find out how it's all going to play out afterwards.
There is one person who is eaten at no fault of the teens.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes me wonder if, you know, maybe the people, the archaeologists, should have been paying more attention to blind sharks.
The film doesn't tell us what to think about that situation.
It does not. But it just occurred to me, there is one death we can't pin on them, so maybe the sharks would have eaten those other people anyway.
The film doesn't tell us what to think about anything. Because the film isn't
The film does not think.
The film isn't thinking about anything. But you know what? I had some thinks in the middle of this movie, and here they are. Don't go places and don't do things, and you won't get eaten. How about that?
Yeah, but then the strangers come to your house, so there's nowhere to go.
I'll figure out a way around those strangers.
Uh-huh, okay. So, all right, you call this film stupid and boring, and I half agree with you. It is stupid. I was not bored.
Yeah, you were jumping like a goose.
Yeah. No, I'm cut That's loose. Listen, cut loose like a goose in the roller of the night. What
the
can I tell you?
The pleasure of this film is going with someone like Alonso Duralde. Because you get to sit next to them while they go, and jump in their seat. That's the only pleasure. The film itself gives you none. But watching your spouse sit next to you and go, bleh, every time the shark comes up.
I'm a very easy bleh for this kind of movie. And so I bled a lot. So I was not bored. It's dumb. It doesn't hold up to any scrutiny. The characters are not interesting.
None of them.
You know, they don't give them the kind of, like, I'll tell you, the further we get away from The Shallows, the more I appreciate how much backstory we're given about Blake Lively in that movie.
Also, she's a real actress.
Yes.
We haven't determined if these four young women in this film are or are not.
Correct. Yet. Two of them are legacies. Jamie Foxx's daughter and Sylvester Stallone's daughter are among them.
Sistine Rose Stallone and
Corinne Fox.
Corinne Fox.
But, it's nothing special, and it's not nearly as interesting as the first 47 Meters Down.
Nope,
but
I had suspense.
But I don't hate it.
This one does not.
Does not, no, not really. But I don't hate it.
I don't know why you don't hate it.
Because I went bleh a lot. I hate it. And that's all I wanted out of this movie, was the occasional, oh, shark, bleh!
Also, shots lifted directly from Jaws. Like, directly from Jaws. And each time they did it, I was like, Jaws. 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 Including a chomped off head floating out of a hole to scare somebody. Pivotal Jaws moment.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, let's just do that. It was so effective in Jaws. God. I hate feeling like I've wasted my time. When I come out of a film like this. And that's how I feel. I feel like I wasted my time.
I can't argue that with you.
Sitting next to you jumping. Also the fact that before the film, I got to eat a warm brownie with a scoop of vanilla ice cream on top.
That was a plus.
That was a plus. The only plus. That's it. What other movies did we see this week?
Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
Yeah. Which is getting scathing reviews.
Yes. Not entirely. I mean, Justin Chang liked it quite a bit.
Did he?
Yes.
Well, Justin's right.
He is. I really enjoyed this film.
Oh, this and Blinded by the Light. I love both of these movies.
We'll get to Blinded by the Light in a moment. But yeah. This is based on a novel that neither of us have read.
Correct. And
apparently, if you have read the book, you are super mad about this
movie. If you've
read
the book, you're angry. That's all I know so far. Everyone I talk to who has read the book, every review I've read from people who've read the book, they are hopping mad.
And also, every description...
But I haven't read the book, so...
Every description of the book I have read seems to make it impossible to do a direct adaptation of.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what anybody thought a movie of that book was going to be if that book is as it is... I keep reading it described.
Yes.
So, the film, which we have seen and will discuss, stars Cate Blanchett. She lives in a huge, falling apart, like, in need of renovation house in Seattle. Her daughter...
It is a former reform school.
Yes, for
and
girls.
And is approximately 9,000 square feet.
Yes.
Yeah.
When we first meet her, we know that she is cranky and unhappy. She has a wonderful daughter that she's close to who is on the verge of high school and wanting to go to boarding school because that's what both of her parents did, and is married to Billy Crudup, who is a Microsoft guy who is creating software that can read your mind and turn it into emails. And we see that she...
A plot line that goes nowhere, by the way.
Yeah, it does. I don't know where it would go, but it doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
So anyway, so she is at odds with the other moms of the school where the daughter goes, including her neighbor, Kristen Wiig. And as the movie progresses, we come to find out that, oh, okay, Bernadette, as it turns out, is like one of the great architects of the 20th century.
Yes.
She won a MacArthur Genius Grant.
Yeah.
But after a few professional setbacks and her decision to raise a family, she has taken herself out of the game and is now, like, very frustrated. The only, apart from her daughter, the only person she seems to have any kind of relationship with is a digital personal assistant in India.
Yeah.
So over the course of the film, there is the destruction of a house in a mudslide. There is... what is happening? I think
Michael
out
Vick
there?
Is dogfighting outside. Yikes. Can we pause this recording until
yeah,
that takes,
sure.
until it's over?
I think they calmed down. Okay, I think it's over.
Are we back recording again?
Yes, yes.
What the hell was that?
I have no idea. there's a mudslide. There is a Russian identity theft ring. There's almost the possibility that, like, that she's going to be institutionalized.
Yes.
But then instead, there's a family trip to Antarctica, and things happen.
Pretty much.
And here's the thing: after I saw the movie. You know, and I posted on Facebook that I was seeing it. I had all these people saying, ugh, I hated the trailer. And my first thought was like, I have no idea how you make a trailer for this movie.
The trailer is very strange and makes it look like a goofy comedy about nothing.
Yeah, or like some sort of weird kind of like, it's my turn sort of.
Something
you know,
like that.
Yeah, I don't even know what's going on. But again, I think... Part of what I like about the movie is that it's so hard to sort of sum up and to capture the mood of it and to capture that character who is so wonderfully prickly but interesting and has all these other layers going on. So, yeah, I don't envy the people who had to market this movie, which I guess is why it's been so badly marketed. And so I think a lot of people, sight unseen, just thought, oh, well, this is going to suck. It's an art house film that's opening in August with this terrible trailer. And why haven't I heard more about it? And why are they holding the trailer, the reviews so late? So it's really good, though.
My understanding of what the people who love the book are unhappy about is that the book would appear, based on these reports,
uh-huh.
to be, you know, a sort of unusually and intricately constructed thing.
Yes, it's emails and bills and phone messages and...
Now, maybe that means that Richard Linklater is not the guy for this.
Could be.
Because he's not that guy.
No.
His films are quite often just about... hanging out with the characters that he likes.
That's what somebody said was that his, and I didn't entirely agree with this, but they said that his best films are just the Hang movies, and, like Boyhood and the Before trilogy. And
this feels somewhat like that because she goes from, Bernadette, the character, goes from incident to incident, misanthropically bothering people, barging through, getting her way.
Not wanting to be bothered.
And not wanting to be bothered. And so, however, Linklater clearly loves this character.
Yes.
And all...
And she's played by Cate Blanchett.
All the narrative threads are subservient to his adoration of her.
Mm.
And his adoration of this person who is a genius and who is... clearly better than everyone else that she encounters. No one is good enough for her, not her terrible neighbor, not her terrible neighbors, not Billy Crudup, who is, you know, obviously in love with her and adores her, but is so consumed with his own work that he sort of distances himself from her over time, primarily because she's distanced herself first. Not even the kid, who's very sweet and adores her, and she adores the child, but the kid is not the most narratively interesting person in the world. And so nothing else that goes on in the movie, and a lot of weird things do go on in the movie, like a Russian identity theft ring that she somehow accidentally finds herself involved with. Nothing is more important than her self-actualization. And you finally get Lawrence Fishburne come in two-thirds of the way through the movie to say, why are you around just spinning your wheels doing nothing and pissing people off. Why don't you just go do a creative project and get your life back?
Build a thing.
So she escapes. And then the rest of the film is everyone chasing her. And when they finally catch up with her, and yeah, I'm kind of giving it away, but it doesn't matter because that's not really the point anyway. The point is that this woman escapes a few times throughout the course of the film. The beginning of the film is already post one escape,
right,
that she's pulled off. She keeps escaping until she gets her way.
Mm.
And what I said on KCRW the other day was, imagine Enid from Ghost World growing up and becoming one of the most brilliant architects or whatever of her time.
Sure.
One of the most brilliant creative minds of her chosen field. And still being a total misanthrope. And yet she wins in the end.
You know, but I think, though, that I don't know that Bernadette is a misanthrope. I think that once she
she is.
I mean, for much of the movie,
to everyone except her husband and kid.
For much of the movie, yes. But yeah. I think that once she does have a creative outlet, that allows her to, the way that she responds to people once she is on track to get to do what the thing that she wants to do.
Yes.
It feels like you get to see a whole other side of her sort of open up.
Although she does say the reason she wants to do this project is because no one's going to bother her.
Well, yeah, that's
true.
She's
going to be left entirely alone.
That is a big part of it.
Yeah.
I would have liked to know more about her relationship with Billy Crudup.
I agree with you.
Like, I want to know,
I would have liked more.
Are we supposed to think that he's partially at fault here? Is he just a sort of an innocent bystander to what's been going on? Like, that kind of stuff. But overall,
you don't get a lot of details about the dissolution of their relationship, nor how long it might take for them to rebuild it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't even know, like, has there been a dissolution, or is it just a, you know,
an estrangement?
Yeah. Or just sort of a general kind of
dissolution is too strong a word.
Atrophy.
Because they never split up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's a great sort of parade of character actors. I love it when a director realizes you've got all these people who have like one scene and it's got to count. So I'm going to cast that one scene person.
Yeah.
So it's like Lawrence Fishburne and James Urbaniak and Judy Greer and Kate Burton and, you know,
Steve Zahn, Megan Mullally,
yeah. David Paymer, all these amazing people. Give this movie a shot if you haven't read the book.
It is very strange. It is the loosest of stories.
Yeah.
And that might not be what you want if you love the book.
True.
But it is, it's so unusual, and it's just about this strong character. Cate Blanchett is, listen,
Davoon.
She's perfect. Cate Blanchett is perfect. And we all know this to be true.
Yeah.
And so, she brings you all the Blanchett that you want. And by the end, I was moved by the happiness that she's finally allowed.
Yeah, no, it is a movie about, you know, and this is a phrase that I hate because it's been misused and barfed out by so many of the wrong people, but it is a movie about finding joy.
Yeah.
I would also put this in the category of movie that people might take more seriously if it were in French. I think sometimes there's a kind of narrative that people don't know what to do with in an American movie, but if it were in French, they would go with it. Just saying.
And I don't know why that is, but I do know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And then there's Blinded by the Lights.
You guys.
A movie I wish I liked as much as you did.
Okay, say your thing. Because I have a lot to say.
Okay. I want to say this up front.
Tell people what it's about.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. All right. It is based on a true story. It is about a teenager growing up in the outskirts of London in a small town called Luton, whose parents were Pakistani immigrants, and it's the late 80s. So, you know, there's lots of racism afoot and lots of economic opportunities drying up in Margaret Thatcher's England.
Yes.
And his life is changed when a friend turns him on to the music of Bruce Springsteen.
Yes.
And it is basically about that. That's what it is about. And it is constantly telling you that it is about that. my caveat here is that I don't know a lot about Bollywood musicals.
All right.
And I have heard critics talk about the fact that Gurinder Chadha, who's the director of the film, is using the Bollywood ethos, the Bollywood aesthetic of characters bursting in a song or whatever, but having it be Bruce Springsteen songs.
Yes.
And so it may be that there's a whole thing going on there that she is referencing that I don't get.
Okay.
But on its face, as it is, I think there are a couple of the musical sequences that I love. Like the Born to Run sequence of this film is my favorite thing in a movie all year.
It's so wonderful.
But the rest of the movie I just found kind of like really repetitive and really on the nose. And I felt like in the Born to Run moment, it best encapsulates that feeling that you get when you respond to a musician and you feel like that musician is telling you your life and sees you and feels you and understands you and explains you. I got that there. I also got it a little bit in the other, what's the other big musical sequence in the marketplace where he's sort of flirting with the girl that he wants to go out with.
What song are they doing that to?
I can't remember. Is it the river?
Yeah.
It's the not Rob Corddry, the other guy, the guy from The Trip. Rob Brydon.
Yeah.
Anyway, whatever that song was, those were my two favorite parts of the movie. But then beyond that, I don't know. I felt like I was watching one of those Broadway musical, one of those jukebox musicals where they keep shoehorning in the songs, you know?
Yeah.
The appeal to me was not consistent. But like I said, my favorite sequence in a movie all year, so I'll give it that.
I don't know how to say the name of the actor who plays Javed. Vivek Kalra?
Okay.
I'm just going phonetically from IMDb. he's so dorky. And so earnest. And so just wide open. And the film hinges on him. And he is kind of perfectly cast as this young, sort of uncertain teenage boy.
He has a very open face.
Yeah. You very rarely see films that get this one very specific thing's right. This one very specific thing, right? And it's what happens when you discover a musician or a band that feels like your identity.
That's me.
That's me, yeah. Like in Velvet Goldmine.
Yes.
When Christian Bale is pointing at the TV and yelling at his mother, that's me, that's me, that's me. He's watching Top of the Pops, I think. And who's on the screen?
It's
Ewan McGregor.
I thought it was the other
guy. No, it's Jonathan Rhys-Meyers.
Jonathan Rhys-Meyers.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, there's a book that I own that I'm sure lots of you have heard of. It's called Our Band Could Be Your Life.
Right.
And it's a collection of essays about various punk and indie rock bands of the 1980s and 90s that developed cult followings among people, you know, for whom that band became everything. Mm-hmm. And Our Band Could Be Your Life is a line from a Minutemen song, and they are one of the bands in the book. And so, now Springsteen is not in that book, but Springsteen is the mass appeal version of that, of that, you know, paradigm?
Yes.
So this is a story about a young teenage boy who finds his identity, finds his direction, finds inspiration to become what he needs to become, to make the various parts of his life that don't feel like they fit together, to make them fit together.
Right.
And it is so sweet and guileless and earnest and corny. So corny. So corny, I should hate it. So corny, I should dismiss it and, you know, stick my nose in the air. But it's so warm and emotionally true that even the parts that are cinematically sort of clunky feel like they fit when it all is over. The visual trick of throwing the lyrics to the Springsteen songs on the screen while he is, you know, having emotions. The first time it happened, I went, oh no. Because I hadn't seen the trailer.
Oh, okay.
I thought, oh no, no. No, don't do this. No, 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 no. Don't. This is bad. Don't do this. And then they kept going. Like, it does it a lot. And by about the end of the first song, I thought, okay, I get it. Keep doing it. Oh, you're going to keep doing it? Fine. Keep doing it. I fully agree with you about the Born to Run number. It's ecstatic and thrilling. Yes. And it's when you are inside a movie in your head, you're inside a music video in your head, because that's really what it all ends up looking like.
Yeah, totally.
That Born to Run number looks like a music video that he's imagining.
Mm-hmm.
And he is imagining it. It's not really happening. Or maybe it is. And maybe that's the Bollywood-esque-ness of it. But I cannot love this film enough. I said on the radio, it's like a dog starts licking your face. And you're like, stop licking my face, dog. And then like 30 seconds in, you're like, all right, just lick my face for 90 minutes. You and me, we're going to be happy together.
I've been hearing people compare it to Sing Street. And I like Sing Street better as a movie about...
Okay, I understand what you mean.
A kid finding his voice. I don't know. I just...
But here's what else. Say what you're going to say, but I have other things.
No, I just, about. You know, I think it worked. I think Begin Again, even, is it's like a kind of a better movie about this sort of thing. And I think there are... this movie, I can't quite wrap my head around what it's even trying to do, because it is literal fan service. but even so, like, and I mentioned this on KCRW, like, for a movie where this guy's going deep into Springsteen and his whole life is about Springsteen, they kind of focus on like four or five hits.
The hits, yeah, they stick with.
You know,
the hits.
No one's listening to Nebraska in this movie.
No, because that's a bummer.
No matter how grim things get, nobody listens to Nebraska.
Nebraska is the record you listen to, like, fifth. But after you listen to Nebraska, you go back and you re-listen to those other records, and everything just sounds darker.
Is tinged.
Yeah. Now, I believe also that this film is sort of a way to recenter Bruce Springsteen in the narrative of the 1980s. Because the farther we get away from the 1980s, which is when he blew up.
Yeah.
Like, Born to Run was from the 1970s. And he had, like, a couple other songs in the 70s that were chart hits.
Mm-hmm.
But Born in the USA, the album.
Yes.
His seventh album, sixth or seventh album.
That was like fourth or
fifth. Was when he blew up globally.
Yes.
Right? And what happened immediately when he blew up globally? What happened in the United States the year he became super famous, a household name?
The awful people that he sang about tried to claim him for their own.
The awful people that he sang about tried to make him one of their own by taking his song, specifically Born in the USA, and trying to use it to run political campaigns with.
Yes.
Invariably, this was a Republican. And every time it happened, including Ronald Reagan and George First Bush.
H.W.
Each time, Springsteen said, stop it. You're not the heroes of these songs.
You're the villains.
You're the villains. And he explicitly said that. But sometimes it felt like no one was listening to him. Sometimes it felt like no one was listening to the lyrics of his songs.
Seventh album, you're right.
Sometimes it felt like no one was listening to the lyrics of his songs.
Yes.
Or him personally when he would speak. Because this was a guy singing songs about the people who get forgotten. And the people whose lives stay small. And how to have hope in the midst of a life like that. And so what I would like for this film to maybe remind people of is that this guy's music is not rah-rah USA, USA,
stadium rock,
Trump,
yeah.
Trump, Trump. It's not that.
No.
And it never has been that. And he has never been that guy. Well, and so in the service of that,
sure.
This film makes very, very pointed use of Margaret Thatcher
mm-hmm.
and Ronald Reagan
yes.
to highlight the devastation that their legacies left behind.
Well, because, you know, somebody like Billy Joel is writing prose and Springsteen is writing poetry.
Correct.
So, you know, Billy Joel does Allentown and you know exactly what that song is about.
Yes.
But Springsteen,
it's
you
about
have
one
to,
thing.
Yeah. You have to pay attention to what he's talking about.
Yeah. So it's also about racism. It's also about immigration. It's also about, you know, families, whose lives are not that of the dominant community.
Right.
You know, and so there's so much going on in this movie. It's about so many different things. And it's in this adorable, cuddly package. And I got all choked up. Twice. I love it. I love it so much. And maybe I shouldn't. Maybe it's not cinema
no,
as, the, as I have been
look,
like,
I,
pounding
I,
on that idea for the
I,
past
I feel
years
like an outlier because so many people that I trust love this movie. But yeah, it does seem on paper the kind of movie that I would fall for and you wouldn't.
But I am full ham into this one. I love it.
All right. Before we get into letters, two things real quick.
Oh, we got some letters?
Yeah, but before that, first of all, hey, we have a Patreon, as mentioned earlier.
Yeah, we do. We got a Patreon.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife, where we offer extra content for subscribers. Things like LKTV, a podcast of the television, and Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics,
yep.
and Linoleum Nights, plus all that merch that Dave was talking about earlier. Like
you can have one.
Pins and magnets and mugs and Christmas ornaments and
one thing.
Shirts and all kinds of things. Even a private knife, which is you give us a topic and we give you a 15 to 20 minute podcast just for you.
Yeah, what thing do you want us to talk about?
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. The second thing is on the Criterion channel, we always like to check out what's going to be expiring at the end of the month. And we decided last night to watch George Stevens' Swing Time.
Do we have enough time to talk about Swing Time? I feel like that could be a whole podcast.
That's, yeah, there's a lot of ground. I mean,
what a movie.
I had recommended it as a DVD pick a month or two ago because Criterion put out a new Blu-ray of it. Yeah. And at the time I said I hadn't seen it.
I had never seen it until last night.
I immediately got a message from our dear listener, Dr. Steve.
Dr.
He was like,
Steve.
Hey, do you know there's a big blackface number in that movie?
Blackface like, in this movie?
I did not.
Yeah.
And,
well, now we know.
Yeah, boy, is there. And also, there's a lot of other weirdness with this movie. As somebody who's seen a lot of the other Astaire Rogers movies.
Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Play,
legendary dance duo.
Play two people who dance together.
But Astaire's character in this one is like a compulsive gambler who's not very nice.
He's... We would, okay, in 2019, we would call him a toxic man.
Yes, which is not the case in the other Astaire Rogers movies necessarily. I mean, yes, he's a bit of a charming, you know, rogue, and she's always portrayed as a bit of a stick in the mud who is engaged to the wrong person. But in this movie, they really push him.
He is, he's a rapscallion. He's a rascal.
Yeah,
he's a
roué.
He's, but the movie loves him for
yes.
it. Like, the movie cannot stop adoring him every time he does something absolutely hideous to Ginger Rogers.
And his fiance early on.
And she kind of just
rolls with it.
Yeah, she kind of thugs it out through the whole movie, just dealing with it. And every time he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry. Would you like to dance?" She's like, "Sure."
And when they dance, wearing a gown. And when they dance, it is transcendent. Like, no, let there be no doubt about that.
Each dance sequence in this movie is more exciting than the last, and the final one, set on the glitteriest, gleamingest,
yes,
double level stage, is staggeringly beautiful. Like, maybe one of the best things I've ever seen in terms of dance. And that's, you know, that's why it's got its own Criterion disc. That's why it's a classic. That's why, you know, it's on the Criterion channel. But oh my.
Yeah. When they're not dancing.
When they're not dancing, it's bonkers. And so.
Also, some great songs, by the way. Like,
great songs.
This is where
The Way You Look Tonight.
The Way You Look Tonight and A Fine Romance come from.
And we haven't even gotten to the blackface part.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's more than just a blackface number called Bojangles.
Yes.
It's an entire scene after the Bojangles number where Fred just walks around in blackface having a series of plot things happen. So, I'm doing a lot of thinking about this movie since we watched it last night.
Uh-huh.
And I was trying to think, like, what would a 1936 audience have made of this? Because all films in 1936 were not like this.
No.
Removing the dance element
sure.
from it. We're just talking about the plot and the misogyny. And I'm trying to imagine being an audience, a person in the audience in 1936. A white person
right
in the audience, because frankly in 1936 white people did not care about blackface.
No.
It was just a thing that people did. It was part of the culture.
Yeah.
People saw it and they said, "Oh, I love it when they do that.
How like, entertaining.
How entertaining that is." That's what would have happened in 1936. But I'm talking about the wild, you know, antics behavior of this man. I'm wondering if, and I can't speak for people in 1936,
sure,
but I'm just guessing. I'm wondering if you go see a movie like this in 1936 and it already begins to feel like it's coming from the moon and not Earth, because everybody is stunningly rich, beautiful, well off, wearing beautiful clothing. The sets are, as I said, often sparkling.
Right.
You know?
Art deco.
Yeah. And it makes me wonder if audiences then might have said, okay, well, I understand this to be a fantasy that's existing outside of any kind of reality that I know.
Mm.
And am I just going to go with it? Am I accepting the idea that dancing covers a multitude of sins? If this man is behaving like a cad toward her, is dancing fixing it?
Right.
Is dancing the film's idea of a resolution to this man's rotten behavior?
Right.
And we are kind of led to believe that, yeah, it is, because every time he does something bad to her,
then they dance and it's okay again. And that is a standard trope for their movies, especially and a lot of times for musicals, you know, where instead of a conversation, they have a pas de deux, you know.
Right. So now, as for the blackface, that's it's historical, and that's the only thing you can say about it.
Yeah.
If you've never seen a black and white film where characters put on blackface, just go back about 70 years and you'll start to see it.
Yes.
It stopped. When did it stop? The 50s?
Probably. I mean, roughly. You know, I think the fact that they didn't do it in White Christmas, even though they come real close.
They do it in Holiday Inn. They do not do it in White Christmas.
Yeah.
But it's... there's almost nothing to say other than... go watch the Toni Morrison documentary.
Yes.
Because her understanding of American history...
indeed. And culture.
Is a rebuke to all of it.
Mm.
I wonder sometimes also... I don't even wonder. I think they should. I think these films should come with a note.
Yeah, some cultural context introduction.
Some content notes before the film is on. You know, I know they don't do intros on Criterion Channel, yeah, but they do them on TCM. And you'll often, now you'll see, we've started to see on TCM now.
Yes, they let you know it's coming.
Ben or Alicia will, I'm sorry, Ben Mankiewicz or Alicia Malone.
Yes.
We literally are on a first name
basis with these
people.
I was going to say, we get to do that.
So I forget sometimes.
We're not being gross.
Okay. Anyway, they will talk about this stuff before the film. Here's what's going to be in this movie. Here's why.
Yeah.
And there's no getting around it.
No, it's a thing that happens.
There's no apologizing for it. There's no equivocating about it. There's no
rationalizing it.
There's no saying, well, it was the 1936, so it was fine.
Yeah.
It was 1936, and it was fine to a lot of people then.
Yes.
A lot of white people. Mm. We know differently now.
Yes.
It should not have happened. But it's the outgrowth of musical forms that started in the 19th century,
mm-hmm,
that took black music and black lives and made caricatures of it for white audiences.
Right. And then you also had like a generation of immigrant songwriters who didn't really know the full history.
Who didn't understand what they were doing.
Exactly.
Yeah, and who loved minstrelsy.
Yes.
And so the book by Jody Rosen called White Christmas goes well into this.
Yes.
And
there are a lot of...
There are other books.
Academic studies about blackface in general, yeah.
Yeah. And about racism in American music.
Yes.
Going back to people like Stephen Foster.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot of homework that you could do about this.
Or you could just fast forward
done some of our homework.
When Fred and Ginger dance. Just watch that.
No, you know what? If you're going to watch this movie, I think you should watch it from beginning to end. It's an 83-year-old movie.
Yeah.
Imagine that. Mm. It's a movie from 83 years ago.
Yeah.
The world was radically different 83 years ago.
Totally.
And then also not exactly quite so different than it is now. It's just that we understand it differently.
Yes.
If we are thoughtful people.
Yeah. Well, anyway, on the Criterion Channel till August 31st.
Yeah. Ooh, that dancing.
Yeah. What's your DVD pick this week?
Well, it was going to be Day of the Dolphin. But that's impossible to get, apparently.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Not available. I looked it up and couldn't find it anywhere.
Huh.
That was a movie I loved when I was a kid.
Well, Mark Harris is doing a whole big bio of Mike Nichols right now, so
really?
I'm sure he'll be talking about it.
I'd watch that one again right now. Instead, there's a Jaws ripoff movie from 1976 called Mako, Jaws of Death. It's about a person who psychically communicates with sharks. In its original run at my local movie theater in 1975, I went to see Jaws again and again and again and again. I was 10 when it opened. I turned 11 that summer. Jaws stayed at my local movie theater for 6 months.
Mm, they used to do that.
And this is back in the 1970s when that's how films played out. They rolled out. They stayed there for months and months and months.
There was no home video yet.
Yeah, there was nothing. If you wanted to see the movie, you caught it during its run. Big flops stayed a week, and then you never heard from them again. But huge, huge, huge hits stuck around for months and months. I went to see Jaws so many times, I lost count. I could not go see it enough times. I loved it so much. It was like I was learning about what movies were by watching that movie at least 7 or 8 times in the course of the 6 month run. And I was thrilled by it every time.
I closed my eyes when the ads came on television.
I know. Well, you were 3 years younger than I was.
Yes. Still am.
A crucial 3 years.
No, definitely. I saw Jaws for the first time 11, in
right?
college.
Yeah.
Because I was scared.
You were 7
yes.
when it opened.
Yes.
I was 10. Big, big difference.
No, wait. What year was it?
1975.
No, I was 8 then.
You turned 8.
Yes.
Okay. So anyway, 2 years later, here comes Mako, Jaws of Death. I was like, great, another shark movie.
It's got Jaws in the title.
It's got Jaws in the title. I love Jaws. I'm going back. It was not a good movie.
No.
Not a good movie at all.
I did see Orca in the theater. That was terrible.
And yet, when it was over, I thought, still had sharks. The reason I'm recommending it is because we don't do cheap knockoff films as much as we used to, it seems like.
If we do, they go direct to video.
Yeah, but they used to go to theaters.
No, I know. It's
they
like
used to go to movie theaters.
Like Asylum now will do like Snakes on a Train or something,
yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
know. But it's, yeah, you're right. They
but
used to be
in
theaters.
Day, you'd go into the movie and be like, am I seeing Jaws? Like, if you were kind of clueless and dumb, you'd think, oh, I'm one for Jaws. No, 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 sir. This is Mako, Jaws of Death.
Close enough. I'll take it.
So I just, you know, I kind of miss those times where cruddy, cheap knockoffs found their way to your town where there were already limited film exhibition options.
Yes.
And yet somehow they found a way to screen it on one of your town's four possible theater screens.
My pick this week is coming out on Blu-ray, I think for the first time, this week. And it is Nicholas Roeg's The Witches, based on the Roald Dahl novel starring Angelica Houston. And I love this movie so much. And I know a lot of people who love it because they grew up on it, but I was in my early 20s when it came out and I still love it. And I love the fact that I was not yet a member of LA Film Critics, but that year they gave Best Actress to Angelica Houston for The Grifters and The Witches.
Hmm.
I thought it was very cool of them to include that. Yeah, it's great, and it's fun, and it's probably my second favorite Roald Dahl adaptation behind Willy Wonka. And, Angelica Houston gives a deliciously grotesque performance. And it just, you know, Mae Zetterling is a lot of fun in it. It has a good time with the material. And, you know, again, we talk about, like, scary movies for kids. I think it's a great scary movie for kids. It's a horror comedy, but it is definitely creepy. I was having a conversation with somebody recently about movies that scared us as children. They talked about like when the witches all like unmask in that movie, like really freaked them out when they were little. So yeah, The Witches. Nicholas Roeg died like in the last year, right? Fairly recently.
Don't quote me.
I think it was somewhere.
I'm going to agree with you.
I think it was somewhere really something. Right. Anyway, an atypical film for his. I think probably the only film he ever made that you could argue was a family film.
Right.
But yeah. I love it. And
well,
so,
there's also Track 29.
Exactly. Yes. Bring the kids to bad timing. Yeah. You've probably already seen it, but if you haven't, you're in for a treat. The Witches.
Hey, here are two letters.
Okay.
Dear Alonzo. This is from Wilson.
Okay.
I'm off the hook for this one.
All right.
You recently posted with appreciation a notice about the 35th anniversary of Electric Dreams.
Yes.
I had never heard of this film. I looked at the IMDb entry, and it sounds like this is a remake of Cyrano de Bergerac, where the part of Cyrano is played by a 1984 desktop PC. Please explain yourself.
That is a very good description, because it is pretty much exactly that. It is very much a Cyrano-inspired story where Lenny Von Dolan, a very adorable Lenny Von Dolan, plays a shy architect who lives downstairs from a cellist played by Virginia Madsen, and the computer becomes sentient in a sequence that doesn't make much sense, and basically begins to woo her using electronic music, some of which is produced by Giorgio Moroder. It is a goofy movie, but it is one that I find very charming, and I saw it in its brief release in 1984 and had the soundtrack album, which had like two different Culture Club songs on it, then Heaven 17 and Jeff Lynne and a lot of fun people. Anyway, it has a cult, and in fact, they're about to do a screening on September 7th in Santa Ana. Lenny Von Dolan, Virginia Madsen, and Rusty Lemarant, who wrote the screenplay, are all going to be there. I don't know if I'm going to go, but I would like to go because I do love this movie. And I can't defend it necessarily. It is a silly movie, but it came very early in the wave of movies that were trying to look like MTV.
Oh, yeah.
It was directed by Steve Barron, who did the Billie Jean video. And so, like, he'll send his camera sliding around, like, coffee table tops and stuff and kind of really literally objectify things. It's a cool movie and definitely a time capsule of 1984 coolness.
This is from Stephanie. In a couple of recent episodes, you mentioned the movie Obsessed, starring Idris Elba, Ali Larter, and Beyonce. I remembered seeing ads for it when I was in high school, and I thought to myself, this looks really bad. But last night I watched it when I had trouble falling asleep, and it was the best decision I made that night. Obsessed is bad, and it's good. It's more campy than what I expected, to the point that I'm surprised the movie hasn't hit cult status like The Room. I would say The Room is inept, and Obsessed is just, like, wacky, wild. Yeah. We don't know why Ali Larter is obsessed with Idris Elba, beyond him being nice to her, but she just is. Well, I mean, he looks like Idris Elba. That's,
for starters.
That's one thing, yeah. Well, this is Idris Elba we're talking about. He's completely clean-shaven and almost unrecognizable without a beard or mustache. Beyonce is suspicious from the start, and she has every right to be. It's really ballsy to go after a married man. You'd think that if the man was married to Beyonce, you would back off. Granted, this was before her album Lemonade, but the important lesson of this movie is that you do not mess with Beyonce. I love the podcast. It has an inherent coziness to me as someone who is queer and likes hearing people talk about media. If you are wondering, yes, I also listen to All Things Cozy. And so should all of you.
Indeed, you should. All right, so I guess that brings us to the end. Oh my, this episode went long.
How long are we?
Like 90 minutes.
Woo!
We had a lot to talk about.
Listen, there's too much of us is...
Never enough.
Never enough.
So yeah, go listen to the places I usually send you to go listen to at the end of every episode. And while you're at it, subscribe to this show at Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. We'll read it on the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com and Spotify and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We have a bunch of letters from people who have opinions about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and The Nightingale, and
we
promise
them,
to get
for
to
the
them.
Summer Super Splash
Spectacular that is coming up. So yeah, that's be on the lookout. If you are not somebody who is a Patreon subscriber and you wonder, hey, what are these other shows like? We will soon be offering a little taste as part of our Summer Super Splash while I'm off in Venice. So gird your podcast player for those. It's going to be a hoot and a half, as they say.
Yes.
All
one
right.
Exactly one and a half hoots.
Yes. Those are all the hoots you get. Okay, everybody. Have a good week. We'll catch you next time. Until then,
goodbye.